The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Coral Wong Beach presiding. All of the business before this court draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Judge Peach, and I'm joined by Judge Falvey on my right and Judge Jaquith on my left. We are convened today to consider arguments in the matter of Robert F. Hoffman versus Douglas A. Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 24-7834. Will counsel, beginning with appellate's counsel, please enter your appearance?
Good morning, Your Honor. Christian Scripter for appellant with Amy Odom.
And you have reserved 10 minutes. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Nice to meet you, Your Honors. Dan Hausman for the Secretary. I'm here with my co-counsel, James Cowden.
Nice to meet you, too. Okay, are we ready? Why don't we proceed then, counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. If it please the court, Mr. Hoffman is one of the many veterans who has lost the benefit of their ITF because the board applied the first-in-time rule found in subsection D1, Romanet 2, to their continuously pursued supplemental claim. By its plain language, the first-in-time rule does not apply to supplemental claims, and the Secretary's arguments today are effectively asking the court to rewrite the regulation to fit his new post-MVA interpretation of this rule.
How is that plain from the language of the regulation?
So the plain language of subsection D1 Romanet 2, the first-in-time rule, says that it applies to other types of claims. D1 Romanet 1 applies to supplemental claims. So reading those two subsections consecutively shows that Romanet 1 applies to supplemental claims. Romanet 2 applies to other types of claims, which would exclude supplemental claims. So I think
What's the effect of the MVA case on that calculus?
So the MVA case had no effect on those subsections. MVA, or the Federal Circuit in MVA, struck only the preamble language from the regulation, which excluded supplemental claims from subsection B. They did not touch in relevant parts subsection D or even mention our first-in-time rule here at Romanet 2. So MVA did not touch this particular subsection.
Well, what's the effect of the first full sentence of D1, little to the lies, says it deals with claims that meet the requirements of B, which is where MVA invalidated a portion of it, at least.
The VA receives a complete claim that meets the requirements of paragraph B. Be considered. So apologies, Your Honor, if you could repeat the question.
Arguably, MVA invalidated part of B, mm-hmm. and too little I refers back to B. Mm-hmm. So what's the impact of that? You're right. The MVA doesn't deal with too little I at all, mm-hmm. but too little I does refer back to B that they did deal with.
Right. It does refer back to B, Your Honor, but I think the plain language of the title or caption of Romanet 2 or other types of claims still has to be considered. So, if the other type of claim is considered in subsection B, then you can read them together, but it's still specifically and explicitly only referring to non-supplemental claims here. So
There's another way of looking at it, I suppose. I mean, assume the titles aren't dispositive. Mm-hmm. Okay? Assume that we won't go that far. But if you look at the language of one little I. It deals with incomplete supplemental claims. And two little I deals with other claims other than little I. So what's other than incomplete supplemental claims? It's other claims other than incomplete supplemental claims, therefore including completed supplemental claims.
If we were not going by the captions of each one, then that could be a reading of it. But I do believe that the captions have to be considered for each of those. And the caption for Romanet 1, supplemental claims, would include both complete and incomplete, and just telling the regulation there is saying what to do with an incomplete supplemental claim, I think effectively to make it complete. But I do believe we still have to consider the captions of each subsection there.
And to follow that along, then two deals with what to do with incomplete other claims.
Incomplete other claims.
It talks about the ITF, which is essentially an incomplete claim, mm-hmm. and tells you how to go about completing it, or it gives you at least a time frame for completing it.
So apologies, just if you could repeat the question regarding the other incomplete claims.
Well, if supplemental claims is incomplete supplemental claims are dealt with in the first paragraph and incomplete other claims are dealt with in the second paragraph. That's a way of looking at the two sections, right?
You can look at
the language of the mm-hmm. whole thing. You know, the Supreme Court said captions alone aren't enough. So we look at the text, and the text of I is incomplete supplemental claims, and the text of two little I's mm-hmm. is incomplete other claims.
So I think reading those texts within subsection D generally, D1 basically sets out that these complete claim, the date of claim is the date of receipt of the complete claim, and then Romanet 1 and 2 sort of give variations to that general rule. So when you get to Romanet 1 with the supplemental claims saying if you only have a completed supplemental claim on this date, it could still be considered the date of claim, the earlier date where an incomplete one had been submitted. And the next rule applies to not to other than supplemental claims and saying, even if you submit an initial claim on X date, it can still be treated as received earlier under these circumstances. And in this case, it's saying, if it is attached to an ITF pursuant to subsection B. So it's really just establishing how can we get an earlier date of claim. So I think ultimately the purpose of those two subsections conforms with the overall purpose of the ITF framework, which is to get the earliest possible date of claim that's allowed, by statute. And that just does not, that the purpose there conflicts with the board's actions here of exhausting an ITF with the continuously pursued hearing loss claim that Mr. Hoffman submitted. Because again, that continuously pursued supplemental claim already had a date of claim attached to it. It was the date of the initial claim for hearing loss. So the entire purpose of the ITF framework is defeated when you attach an ITF to that supplemental, that continuously pursued supplemental claim.
Would it still work with other supplemental claims, not the continuously pursued supplemental claims, but the ITF framework would work with the supplemental claim that's essentially a new claim?
Those 5104C, B, non-continuously pursued supplemental claims, that is, attaching those to an ITF does fit within the purpose of the ITF framework generally. But then still by the plain language of the regulation, this first-in-time rule, it says, only the first claim other than a supplemental claim, only the first one is going to be tied to the ITF that is submitted within a year. So even if there were this non-continuously pursued supplemental claim, that because that first in time rule doesn't attach, the ITF can attach to it, but it doesn't exhaust it. The ITF would be exhausted as to a second initial claim pursuant to this rule, but because this rule doesn't apply to supplemental claims, whether you attach it to continuously or non-continuously pursued supplemental claim, it's not going to exhaust it. So it would still be free in this case here to attach to Mr. Hoffman's.
And it doesn't apply to the non-continuously pursued supplemental claims because of your theory about the headings.
Correct, Your Honor. It doesn't apply to any supplemental claim.
Right. If assume mm-hmm. we didn't buy the heading argument, but for some other interpretation of these regulations, we say this doesn't apply to a continuously pursued supplemental claim. Mm-hmm. We could still apply it to a non-continuously pursued supplemental claim.
Correct, Your Honor. The reason that we want to, let me back up 1 second, but we want the court here today to find a fairly narrow holding that the first-in-time rule does not require the board to exhaust the ITF with a continuously pursued supplemental claim. And the board here said, they acknowledged the argument that Mr. Hoffman wanted his initial claim for the stroke and SMC benefits to attach to that ITF, but said, no, we can't do that because of this first-in-time rule, which, after MVA, we have to interpret as applying to all of these claims. Because MVA did not touch that rule, touch that first-in-time rule, it's essentially just a reinterpretation. Nothing about the regulation changed. Nothing about that part of the regulation changed. So we would ask that the court find that the board erred as a matter of law when it applied that first-in-time rule to the continuously pursued supplemental claim here. If that is established as an error, then the next step is Mr. Hoffman's initial claim that it would attach to. So, yes, Your Honor.
With respect to the preamble of 3.155, 38 CFR, let me just read this out loud here, and then I have a question. The following paragraphs describe the manner and methods in which a claim can be initiated and filed. The provisions of this section are applicable to all claims governed by Part 3, with the exception that paragraph B of this section, which is the intent to file, paragraph B of this section regarding intent to file a claim does not apply to supplemental claims. Would it be correct then to say, based on the MVA case, that it would be clearer to say that this section does not apply to continuously pursued supplemental claims?
So in MVA, they were talking about a non-continuously pursued supplemental claim. But at the same time, when they struck that language, post-MVA, we read the regulation with that language struck and everything else in place. So the ITF framework as it stands would include all supplemental claims because there is no restriction saying that it doesn't apply to some type of supplemental claim.
Continuously pursued supplemental claim has its own set of rules, as opposed to which are different from the supplemental claim filed after a year.
Right. So they all do, as the regulation currently stands, they are all within the ITF framework, continuously pursued, non-continuously pursued initial claims. But you're correct, Your Honor, that they are all treated differently by statute and throughout VA's regulations. So just because they are all within the ITF framework doesn't mean they all have to be treated the same. And that's where I think when we get to subsection D, the secretary in writing our first-in-time rule was saying for claims other than supplemental claims specifically, we're going to treat, you know, these initial claims this way by saying that, you know, we have our limiting principle of it has to be within 1 year of the ITF, and we're going to add another limiting principle here by saying that for these types of claims, only the first one applies. But because, again, by its plain language, that does not apply to supplemental claims, I don't think that there's anything. MVA did not invalidate that, and I think that would be because, again, they don't all have to be treated identically within the ITF framework.
Well, the Secretary created this framework and then, you know, accepted out supplemental claims. That whole thing struck. They didn't do a real severance analysis or anything. The whole thing was set up with the view that this doesn't apply to continuous or to supplemental claims.
Mm-hmm. And that's correct. And so it does leave us, I think, having to look to the purpose of the ITF framework. And that is where the board's actions really just diverge from and defeat the purpose, which, again, was to get the earliest date of claim possible.
Okay, so where do they get the authority to do that? Because the statute says that it's going to your effective date's the date of claim. Mm-hmm. Yet the ITF framework gives you kind of when you're thinking about filing a claim, we'll give you that date. What's the gap in the statute that the Secretary was filling with this ITF framework?
So the statute says that the date of claim is the earliest date, and the ITF framework is, I think, defining what is the date of claim. They're saying the date of claim is the date that you tell us you want to apply for benefits. And then once
you don't have to give any detail, right?
You have 1 year to then give us the details of what specifically.
I intend to file someday a claim for compensation.
So I think that was the secretary.
That's the date of your claim.
If you then follow that up with.
Where's the gap, though? So this is defining what the. What a date of application is the day you form an intent and express it.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that essentially the definition of the claim is what's left to the Secretary's regulation.
What if we strike down the whole regulation, the whole ITF framework?
If we struck down the entire ITF framework. Yeah. Well, I do.
MVA that they didn't do severance. It's non-severable. The ITF framework falls, and plus it was impermissible gap filling.
So if the court struck down the ITF framework as a whole, then there would be nothing for Mr. Hoffman's initial claim here to attach to. So that would resolve that question. I don't believe the ITF framework as a whole is invalid. Again, I think VA can define or set forth the requirements for a claim. You know, nothing in the statute says that a claim has to include XYZ information. They just say you have to submit a claim. And VA could say submitting a claim is as easy as writing it on a napkin as they used to. They could say you have to submit this particular form that has this particular information, or they could say, you, as they do here with the ITF, you can submit this form, putting us on notice, and then you have a year to complete that claim. But I do think it is a valid, I think Secretary validly, you know, set out this framework. And to continue on, I want to just touch again on the purpose of this regulation, as I think that is just something we don't want to lose sight of. Assuming the ITF framework is valid as a whole, the purpose, again, was to set an earlier date of claim than the date the complete claim was received. So when we apply a continuously pursued supplemental claim or apply an ITF to that continuously pursued supplemental claim, say it was exhausted so that it can't apply to any further claims, that is defeating the purpose because the veteran filed this ITF hoping to get the benefit of the date he submitted it, files his initial claim or his non-continuously pursued supplemental claim within a year. But if it's exhausted by that continuously pursued supplemental claim in the interim, there is no benefit to either the continuously pursued or the new initial claim. So it does defeat the purpose. And I think there's also a question of just whether VA or an agency is allowed to reinterpret a regulation that has not been struck by any court without going through any sort of notice and comment period to put veterans or claimants on notice of what they need to do to preserve their earliest date of claim. If a veteran right now reads 3155 in its entirety and reads MVA cover to cover, they would be pretty hard pressed to put two and two together to realize, oh, I shouldn't submit any continuously pursued supplemental claim until I first file my initial claim, because even though D1 Romanet 2 says it doesn't apply to supplemental claims, I have to reinterpret that following MVA. The secretary hasn't put forward this reinterpretation anywhere. What the secretary has to do is rewrite the regulation, propose an amendment to the regulation if he wishes it to be anything different than what the plain language says it is post-MVA. And he can do that. He can propose any regulation that he wishes and go through that notice and comment period, at which time veterans will be on notice that they have to comply with those regulations. I do see my time has expired, so if there are no further questions.
If you don't mind, I have a question. Let me just shift gears a little bit on the facts of this case regarding the ED, the ED case. Mm-hmm. You have it listed as his onset of ED as 2008. Mm-hmm. But the medical records seem to show that the diagnosis was in November of 2023. So if I could just get clarification on when the ED was diagnosed, when the onset, when was there a...
The first actual diagnosis, I'll try to find the date for that. I believe it was the VA examination that said the onset date was the 2008 date. I believe that was don't have the exact R site of the examination in front of me, but I do think that it was that 2023 diagnosis from the VA examination saying that it had been onset since 2008. I don't have in front of me, Your Honor, the an R site with the actual first diagnosis, but I will look into that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Judge Falvey, Judge Aikwit, Judge Peach, may it please the court. The secretary urges the court to hold that a supplemental claim is included in 38 CFR 3.155 D1 Romanet 2. As a result, the July 2023 initial claims on appeal do not associate with the February 2023 intent to file. I intend to speak to three broad points today. The first is that subsequent to Military Veterans Advocacy versus Secretary of Veterans Affairs, the 2021 Federal Circuit Court case, which I'll refer to as MVA, 38 CFR 3.155 D1 Romanet 2 includes supplemental claims. The second thing I'll speak to is why appellant's primary arguments are unpersuasive. And the third thing I'll speak to is why the Secretary's proposed remand for the board to address fair process in the first instance is appropriate here. So the question today is whether 38 CFR 3.155 D1 Romanet 2 applies to supplemental claims. There's been no challenge to the validity of only one claim associated with an intent to file or only the first one associated with the intent to file. There's also been no challenge to the overall validity of 38 CFR 3.155. So we don't have to get to those issues today. The primary point is that the Federal Circuit in MBA interpreted supplemental claims and initial claims to be essentially interchangeable as far as intent to file is concerned. And I have specific language that speaks to that from MVA. A broad statement that tells VA it is to include supplemental claims in the intent to file framework. That is the holding of MBA, and I quote, excluding supplemental claims from the intent to file framework is arbitrary. MVA also made it so that the mechanism to not consider supplemental claims as part of the intent to file is invalid. And again, I quote a specific holding from the MBA, Section 3.155's preamble, to the extent that it does so, is invalid. So the Secretary's position is this is a broad...
That was the only thing MVA invalidated, wasn't it? The preamble.
Well, Your Honor, that's what they specifically invalidated with that language. But the Secretary's position is that a broad holding impacts every part of 3.155 that addresses the intent to file. This includes D1 Romanet 2, which is facially about the intent to file.
But MVA doesn't address that subsection at all, does it?
Well, Your Honor, they don't specifically address that subsection, but they are aware in their broad invalidation that VA is treating both types of supplemental claims continuously pursued and the over a year period claims. They're treating them both the same in 38 CFR 3.155, and then they have that broad invalidation anyway. I don't think there's a way to read MVA and the regulation in concert and find that MVA doesn't do anything to D1 Romanet 2.
Can you add to your concert the statute? How is it that under your reading of the regulation, the secretary can cut short the one-year look back for supplemental claims? Not continuously pursued supplemental claims.
And I'll just say again that...
They're basically shortening it, right? Or at least not giving the veteran the advantage of it, the benefit of it, when they say, nope, it's going to go back only so far as the ITF, or it's going to eat the ITF.
Well, Your Honor, first, I don't think that is a subject of this appeal necessarily, because appellant hasn't argued that the intent to file framework in 3.155 is invalid. If that were the case, they would get no benefit here for that later claim.
I know they're not arguing, but that's a way that you could argue and win the case.
We're not arguing that here today, Your Honor. So we're going to stick to what was presented for this court. And I understand what you're saying, but that we're not going that far today here. I don't think that was briefed for the court. What I do think, though...
Could you identify for me the gap in the statute, though, that the ITF framework fits?
Yes. So I in a sense, agree with what appellant was saying as to that gap. So what they said is that essentially how I see it is the intent to file and that structure modifies the actual date of that later subsequent claim. So the intent to file is just serves as a placeholder, and then the future claim is then considered filed as of that date of that placeholder. So it's actually 3.155 operates and coexists with 38 U.S.C. 5110 to establish the filing date. It's something on top of the statute. And I think that appellant, from what I heard today, very much misunderstands the purpose of intent to file. Appellant claimed that the purpose is to get the earliest effective date, but that's not the purpose. What the intent to file does is just set a placeholder. Then everything that happens subsequent impacts and relates back to that placeholder. So it just makes
only
it so.
Only the first thing, though.
And that's the first thing, correct.
Under D1, Roman II. Aren't you saying the same thing? The placeholder is important because of its effect on the effective date.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the placeholder itself is merely a placeholder, and then all of the effective date is downstream from that. The subsequent claims are essentially, and 3.155 is agnostic to the effective date. All it is doing is making the later claim be able to be considered filed or received as of the date of that intent to file.
So the placeholder theory, I mean, the way you propose it, explain it, is you file and I have an intent to file, and then that places it's a placeholder for some future claim to come in. Now, if the future claim is a supplemental claim, then some kind of inspection or diagnosis has to be made on that supplemental claim to determine if it's a continuously pursued claim, supplemental claim, or a supplemental claim that's not continuously pursued. So if it's a continuously pursued claim, then you're saying the placeholder will give the effective date of that continuously pursued supplemental claim.
Yes, Your Honor, that would be considered filed. The continuously pursued claim would be considered filed as of that intent to file date. And I'll just give you an example of how that would work practically. So, for example, a veteran could file a intent to file 11 months after they've received an adverse decision. So the intent to file is 11 months. And then another 11 months later, they could file their first subsequent complete claim, which would be a continuously pursued supplemental claim, which is now 22 months from that original adverse decision. But since that continuously pursued supplemental claim relates back to the 11 months, that is within that time period, they're able to get the benefit from a continuously pursued claim.
Doesn't once that claim is filed after more than a month after the 11th month, you talked about something about being in the 11th month, they file, what did they file in the 11th?
Intent to file.
Okay, and then they submitted the claim sometime thereafter.
Yes, Your Honor, a supplemental claim. So just on the supplemental claim, without considering whether the intent to file at all, I'm saying in my hypothetical that supplemental claim is outside of the one-year period. So through the intent to file mechanism, as a placeholder, the supplemental claim looks at that date of the placeholder and then is now within the one-year period and is a continuously pursued claim rather than the over 1 year supplemental claim. And then it gets that benefit of an effective date that can be as early as an initial claim based on the continuous pursuit. Okay.
Let me test this. That they all work in concert a little bit. Okay. Let's say that on the 1st of April, April Fool's Day this year, I got a VA decision denying my back claim. And I sit there and I say, okay, well, I've got a year now to file a supplemental claim. But today I decide I want to file an ITF for hearing loss. And under the ITF regulation, then I'd have a year to perfect that ITF. But a week from now, I file my supplemental claim. I do it early. I don't wait the full year. I have to. I do it next week. That supplemental claim, completely unrelated to my ITF, eats the ITF, doesn't it? I don't get the year to perfect anything because of the associated with will be the supplemental claim is associated with the ITF, even though my intent was I'm filing a claim, which you told me could be very vague, very general. My mind was, this is my hearing loss.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the veteran loses the benefit of those two periods of grace given by the secretary in the statute, by Congress and the secretary, without any notice, any knowledge as I'm eating one of them.
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't concede that they lose the benefit, because what the benefit really is the extension of time.
Well, the benefit is, as you said, that filing the ITF is essentially the initiation of the claim. It's the application under the regulatory the framework, the ITF framework. That this is filing the intent to is essentially applying. And it was applying. Let's say I'm even specific. This, I intend to file for hearing loss. And then my supplemental claim comes in and it burns it. It burns the ITF. Unrelated, it's a supplemental claim having to do with my back. How can that be?
Well, Your Honor, I do disagree with that categorization that you had there.
Which part of it?
The intent to file simply serves as a placeholder for the next complete claim, whatever that may be, under 38 CFR 3.155 D1 Romanet 2. So that is line drawn by the secretary on what they're going to consider as associating with that intent to file. And the secretary has decided that pursuant to 38 CFR 3.155 D1 Romanet 2, that that's going to be the first one and only the first one.
Yep. Okay. So it's essentially you're saying the secretary can give grace, the secretary can take grace away.
Well.
Right? And nothing wrong with that. I'm just.
In a way, yes, because the secretary, and I'll quote a case here as to the efficiency benefit that the secretary can enjoy. This case is Veterans Justice Group, LLC versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, a 2016 Federal Circuit Court case. VA possesses a duty not only to individual claimants, but to the effective function of the veterans compensation system as a whole. Moreover, because the VA possesses limited resources, these dual obligations may sometimes compel it to make necessary trade-offs. The trade-off here being the ease of associating only the first, only and first supplemental claim with intent to file versus what would be needed to adjudicate over time multiple different claims that may not even be final to eventually look back and try to see what might be the best effective date for a veteran.
Okay. The regulation was written pre-MBA, obviously. MBA invalidated a portion of it. At the time, I believe, it was indicated that VA was rewriting the regulation. What's the status of the rewrite?
The status is that they're still in discussions about rewriting. But I'll add to that that the secretary believes it's clear based on MBA read in conjunction with the regulation as a whole that D1 Romanet 2 includes supplemental claims.
Okay. Well, it doesn't include all supplemental claims, right? Because D1, little I, deals with incomplete supplemental claims.
Sorry, Your Honor, I misspoke. Complete claims. 38 CFR 3.160A complete claims are the ones that are part of D1 Romanet 2 and B, and that includes supplemental claims, but not incomplete supplemental claims. As you stated, D1 Romanet 1 speaks to incomplete supplemental claims.
That's not the interpretation that VA offered in arguing MBA, is it?
So what VA did in MBA was speak to the underlying statute, 5110, and VA said that A3 would act differently than A1 to be able to come to a different result and require that supplemental claims be treated differently. The court in MVA did not agree with that reasoning, essentially stating that if the intent to file can act as a placeholder, which can eventually lead to an earlier effective date, earlier than the final receipt or final filing because of that relation back to the placeholder. And since that's applicable for A3, it's also applicable for A1. Therefore, the difference that VA is speaking to is invalid, doesn't have weight.
Right. No. So MVA found that VA's differentiation between A1 and A3 was arbitrary and capricious. So don't we see meaning in that differentiation because it doesn't even mention A2, which is the continuously pursued supplemental claim subsection?
Well, Your Honor, just specifically in MVA, I think the Federal Circuit Court knew that VA was speaking to all of supplemental claims. Just at 1146 in MVA, the Federal Circuit Court speaks to the prescription of a one-year filing period during which claimants may pursue supplemental claims while maintaining the initial claim's effective date. So that's the continuously pursued claims. And also in that same sentence, they're talking about would allow for supplemental claims submitted beyond the one-year period. So they know VA is looking at supplemental claims interchangeably, the types of supplemental claims interchangeably for the purpose of 38 CFR 3.155. And they still went ahead and went with a broad exclusion of all supplemental claims. They didn't carve out a difference between the over one-year supplemental claims versus the continuously pursued supplemental claims, even though they could have been.
But they didn't specifically say any of that. That's just a sense of the case from VA.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that that's how MVA and the regulation in conjunction should be read as far as D1 Romanet 2 is concerned.
Person files an intent to file a claim, and in that document, in that intent, they say, I intend to file a claim on my back disability. And then a second submission is made where that appellant files a supplemental claim for something different, his knees, because a supplemental claim because he had a ruling on it that now he disagrees with and he's going to file a supplemental claim, and that claim is within the 1 year. Okay, so going back to the intent to file that says specifically for the back, does VA just ignore that language on the regarding what disability?
I believe you're speaking to a specific statement on the intent to file form. Correct, Your Honor?
Well, tell me about that.
Yeah, so that's covered by 38 CFR 3.155 B2, where there's a statement that extraneous information does not convert the intent to file claim into a complete claim or substantially complete application. The provision of such information is no effect other than is added to the file. So the regulation does already speak to that and say that that wouldn't.
What was that section again, please?
That's 38 CFR 3.155 B2.
B like in Bravo?
B as in Bravo, yes.
B2.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. An intent to file a claim must identify the general benefit. This is my back disability. But then I next file a document that talks about complete different disability.
Your Honor, the general benefit is the difference between compensation, pension, DIC, that sort of benefit. Where then it talks about the specific benefit and says that the extraneous information is given no effect.
Doesn't VA veer off of its, or at least your point about if the efficiency of linking the intent to file to any sort of next-in-time claim when it specified the kind of claim that would connect to this ITF in its notice, i.e. one that was reflected on a VA Form 21-526-EZ, a regular compensation claim form?
So I think, Your Honor, you're speaking about the acknowledgement letter in March 2023, correct, and what that stated to
Yes.
The veteran. Yes, so I think that's where fair process comes in, and that's not a regulatory issue in this appeal, because we're speaking, again, just to D1 Romanet 2. That's a fair process issue that could affect other aspects of the regulation. Specifically here, I'm looking at 38 CFR. I believe it's – give me 1 second. B3, that's the notification subsection. There's no prescribed rules on what that notification might be. So we could say it's potentially a fair process issue to give a notification that is possibly misinformative to a veteran. I'll explain why in this particular case that needs to be a factual determination made by the board in the first instance.
Why?
Yes, Your Honor. So first, recent cases, Stinson and Tadlock, speak to the idea that all sorts of the full factual determination needs to be made by the board in the first instance. And then the second thing is there are some facts in the record that show that there might have been some actual knowledge of how this regulation works to include the supplemental claim as the first one and only one that it associates. So record at 2316 is direction by appellant's attorney to associate with the February 2023 intent to file. What that could mean possibly, and this is up for a factual interpretation, is there's an implication of actual knowledge of the attorney that when you direct something to happen that doesn't need any direction. Otherwise, like if only the initial claim would be the only one possible, you wouldn't need to direct VA.
It's just as readily confirmation of what the veteran had been told in March.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that's a factual determination that the board needs to make in the first instance about fair process. And that's what the concession of a remand would be.
Don't we have cases, Gomez, I think, is one where waiver and fair process go hand in hand. VA is misinformative, to use your term, and in reliance on that misinformation, veteran does X, and then VA says, you should have done Y, but VA is stuck with X because that's what they told veteran to do.
Well, Your Honor, I see waiver as being something where VA gives up on the actual regulation. Here, VA consistently associated consistently found that the July 2023 initial claim was an effective date of July 2023. VA never took the ITF rule and put that July 2023 claim to that rule. They've always found, in this case, below, that the July 2023 claim would have an effective date based on that claim alone. So it was never associated.
It's too late then. The outcome determinative information has long since been provided. To use the language from Bowles, VA made an unqualified and unequivocal statement regarding how the veteran was to connect his claim to his ITF form in its March 2023 notice. And to call on another of the cases that the parties cite, as the court put in Percy, the veteran is entitled to expect that VA means what it says and rely on that.
Sir, Your Honor, I think that implicates fair process, and it's especially true in this case where what VA was processing at that time of the acknowledgement letter was the intent to file. It wasn't that claim. The claim didn't come into later. So it doesn't make sense to me that VA could give up rights as to a claim that hasn't even been filed as of that date. What they can do and what they did do was potentially impact due to fair process how appellant pursued the intent to file.
If the veteran, if the appellant prevails, we reverse her remand on their theory, do we even get to the fair process or waiver discussions?
Excuse me, if you remand for appellant, is that what you're asking? I think it depends on how that remand is phrased, Your Honor. If there's more for the board to do, which it possibly could be, depending on how you hold, then I think we still would need to possibly get to the waiver. So if, for example, this court held specifically that this May 2023 supplemental claim does not count for purposes of D1 Romanet 2 in this particular case, then I don't think there's anything more to do. But if it's more of a broad holding that says something like just supplemental claims aren't part of D1 Romanet 2, well, then there's no instruction at all for VA as far as what to do with multiple complete claims, and the VA then has to kind of reconcile subsection B with D1 Romanet 2 in the first instance, and there's more to do.
So back to your Romanet 2, in the event multiple complete claims for a benefit are filed within 1 year of an intent to file a claim for the benefit, only the first claim filed will be associated with the intent to file a claim. And then I'm going to add these words to see if this is what you're saying. Only the first claim filed will be associated with the intent to file a claim, even if doesn't make any difference if it's a supplemental claim or pursued, continuously pursued claim. All supplemental claims are included in that?
Correct, Your Honor.
So they would be in the line of fire, so to speak.
Correct, Your Honor, and initial claims as well.
And initial claims, okay.
Correct, Your Honor. So, yes, that would be a rule that would be efficient to follow for VA as well. Get efficiency benefits from them.
So then you'd go back and you would amend the preamble to include the provisions of this section are applicable to all claims governed by Part 3, with the exception of the paragraph 3 of this will not of this section regarding intent to file a claim does not apply to supplemental claim. You just strike that language out?
That was what was stricken by MVA. Or,
yeah, I mean, so, yes. And then you'd amend that Roman number 2 to include all claims, that you would really just say all claims, new claims, pursued supplemental claim, pursued continuously, and then supplemental claims.
Your Honor, as you're saying amend, I think that's better said as that's how you would consider interpret. Yes. Yes.
It already says that. Your point is that it already says what
your
speech is,
Your Honor.
Is suggesting.
Absolutely.
Because it says all other claims in the heading.
Despite the heading? Is that what you're asking now?
No, all other includes.
Oh, yes, because.
Supplemental claims.
It's not an incomplete supplemental claim. Correct, Your Honor. I see that my.
Let me ask that. I want to make sure I understand. So you filed that supplemental claim after an ITF. What's the effective date of the supplement, the continuously pursued supplemental claim? What's the effective date going to be?
So if the supplemental, well, you look at the supplemental claim and then you date that back to the intent to file. So that's the first step. And then you see whether it's over 1 year from the AOJ decision or within 1 year of the AOJ decision. If it's over 1 year, then it's the date of that claim because it's an over 1 year. So over 1 year, 38 CFR 3. 1506 claim at that point. It's over. And then the other way is that, if it's within 1 year, then it would be able to get the benefit of the initial claim earliest effective date possibly. So it basically you're just associating back, and then after that you make that decision of where that fits in, over 1 year or under 1 year.
But by filing that supplemental claim, you don't get the benefit of the ITF.
Well, you did get the benefit of the ITF. So if it's an over 1 year claim, now you
Talking about the under 1 year.
The under 1 year claim. Yes, that extended the amount of time that you could possibly file that claim and have it still be considered continuously pursued, because you'd have the full 12 months.
So maybe you get 2 years.
That's correct, Your Honor. You could get up to 2 years. That is how VA sees that.
Isn't there another differentiation between supplemental claims as a decision review option as compared to initial claims that is manifest in this case, because the supplemental claim for the veteran's bilateral hearing loss actually arises from a higher level review decision that postdates the intent to file? So how can the intent to file cover that bilateral hearing loss? Excuse me.
Oh, so, excuse me, Your Honor. So you're speaking specifically to bilateral hearing loss. And I do agree with you in the sense that of what you're saying there is when there's a decision on appeal and the intent to file, then there's a decision that's still being adjudicated and not final. That's what you're getting at, right? That decision is still being adjudicated and not filed, and the intent to file is prior to that. Well, we would say that then that needs some more discussion by the board, and most likely I would think that that would end up being that couldn't attach to the intent to file. The thing, though, is that 3.155 in this particular case, there's more than just the bilateral hearing loss. There's also the Meniere's, and that would attach. And the other claim as well, the kidney claim as well.
But it introduces a complication to the calculus that doesn't exist for an initial claim and might be a reason for the differentiation between the two.
So, how I think that would work would be, so just as far as this case is concerned, I don't think that ends up being an impact, because there is something else that is associated with that earlier intent to file, which would therefore, through 38 CFR 3.155 D1 Romanet 2, associate first and make it so that the July 2023 later initial claims could not associate with the February 2023 intent to file. That might be a question down the line, but I don't think that's one that's necessary for resolution of this case, because there are those two other claims that would attach and associate. So I'd like to wrap up, because I am over on time here. The Secretary urges the court to hold that the board was correct in finding that pursuant to MVA, the supplemental claim associated with ITF. The Secretary also urges the court to remand based on the fair process issue the Secretary identified. Thank you for your time.
Your Honors, the Secretary's position here that ITFs can apply to these continuously pursued supplemental claims and exhaust them is inconsistent with the litigating position that he put forward in MVA in the first place, where the Secretary said he was planning to amend the regulation to include specifically 5104C-B supplemental claims, which would be the non-continuously pursued supplemental claims. The plain language is ultimately what should guide the court's analysis here. There is no ambiguity in our first-in-time rule that it does not apply to supplemental claims. But even if there were ambiguity in the court's view, the Secretary's interpretation of that can only receive any deference by this court if it is reasonable and consistent with the purpose of the regulation. So to accept the Secretary's position here today, which is contrary to what he was saying 5 years ago in MVA, and is contrary to what he intended with the purpose of the ITF framework initially, I think would just be essentially giving the court's blessing to a reinterpretation of a regulation that has not changed. I want to also make a point regarding VA's overall authority to establish this ITF framework. So 5110 is the regulation that sets out, you know, the earliest date would be the date the claim is received. And Section 501 gives broad discretion to the secretary, and A2 specifically gives him broad discretion for forms of claims and claims processing rules. So under that, that is where 3155 is a valid use of the secretary's regulatory power to say that the form of the claim that he's going to accept is, you know, step one, this ITF, step two, completing it with the necessary information within a year. So if Your Honor has any further questions on that point, I'm happy to discuss that. As far as if the court does reach the waiver argument, I believe reversal is warranted either way here. Under Percy, this court found that reversal was warranted when the board by its actions, or when VA by its actions, failed to enforce a rule. So if the first in time rule does apply to supplemental claims here, there is no dispute what VA said, that they directed Mr. Hoffman here to file his 526. There's no factual dispute for the court to address if it were to go back to address this question again. It would simply be a legal question of whether it meets the standard for waiver under Percy. And here, VA went even a step beyond what it did in Percy. In Percy, it just accepted the substantive appeal as timely for many years and ultimately wrote and said, oh, wait, never mind, this actually is not timely. Here, they didn't just have silence on the question. They said, we will accept it if you submit this 526. So because there are no factual disputes to be made, if the court does reach our alternative argument, I believe it should reverse under Percy as well. And welcome any other questions.
What about the absence of any board findings of fact on when the veterans' entitlements arose?
So the question of entitlement arising, Mr. Hoffman has asserted that he has the disabilities at issue here. We're trying to go back from his July initial claim to his February claim. Whether he has this ED condition is something within a layperson's ability to attest to. So I do not have the date of the actual diagnosis, but the date of a current disability was not in question here. It was simply the date that the claim was received. That's been at issue. So if the court determines that the date of claim should be that ITF, everything else, nothing else had been in dispute either at the AOJ or before the board. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The court thanks the parties for their advocacy, and the case is now submitted.
All rise.